for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. April is National Poetry Month. To mark the occasion, we dedicate this month's Reader's Review to a celebration of verse. Joining us to talk about the pleasures and challenges of poetry are three poets, E. Ethelbert Miller of Howard University and Poet Lore Magazine, Carolyn Forget of Georgetown University, and Edward Hirsch. He's president of the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation. They all join me here in the studio. You are welcome to be part of the program. Share your own thoughts and ideas. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And welcome to all of you. I'm so glad you're here for this month's Reader's Review of Poetry.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Thanks. It's a thrill to be here.
Oh, it's so good to have you here. Carolyn Forget, let's start with you. What do we as human beings get from reading or writing poetry?
I think of poetry as, first of all, it's the oldest art. It touches our souls. It gives voice to our inner beings, and it gives expression to our humanity. And it's been with us for thousands of years in one form or another. All of our religions were born in poetry. And I really think that it allows us to access a knowledge that we can't access by other means.
Edward Hirsch, how is it different from ordinary, if I can call it that, literature?
I think poetry is a form of marked speech. When you read the newspaper, for example, you read the story and you remember the story, but you don't remember the way in which the story is told. But when you read a poem, the way in which the thing is said is inseparable from what's being said. The words carry the meaning. The words speak directly to you. So it's words as words.
Ethelbert.
Well, maybe I can quote Ed from one of his books. I think poetry is also something that brings us pleasure, which is very important. At this particular point in my life, you know, I cherish those moments of pleasure. I also look at poetry as something that helps us deal with the unknown, things that we can't touch or can't explain. This ties back to Carolyn's comments about, you know, the interior journey. For those of us who are poets, I hope that we're on a spiritual journey in terms of trying to find out what is this human condition? How do we deal with love? How do we deal with hatred? How do we better understand the world, you know, not just human beings, but also nature?
Do you remember when you wrote your first poem?
I remember when I heard my first poetry reading, because it was Sterling Brown, you know, and that was here when I came to Howard University, and I walked across the campus and stumbled into a poetry reading. And, you know, I grew up in the South Bronx. I went to Paul Laurence Dunbar Junior High School. No one read a Dunbar poem to me. I didn't really have an idea of what poetry was until I was hanging around some people at Columbus High School and we listened to Bob Dylan records, you know, but and Paul Simon. But, you know, the whole idea of what a poem was would be something that would I would discover, you know, around 68, 69.
68, 69. Yeah. You would have been how old?
I would have been 18.
18. And you, Carolyn, do you remember?
I remember the first poem that I wrote because I'm the eldest of seven children. And when I was 9 years old, we lived in Michigan and we had a snowstorm. So we were snowed in and could not go to school. Seven children and my mother. So she gave us each something to do. And she took out a book of poems and showed me what a sonnet was and said, "Now I want you to write one of these." And
wow.
I fell in love with it.
Wow.
It was a boring poem about snow, but it was my beginning, and it was because of my mother.
How lovely. And you, Edward?
I can't remember exactly the first poem, but I can say that I began writing when I was in high school, and I would say it was really out of emotional desperation.
Like what?
I just had feelings that I couldn't control, and I didn't know what to do with them. And I somehow stumbled upon poetry as a way to kind of explain my feelings to myself, and I felt better when I wrote it. I didn't know much about poetry per se, but when I expressed it and tried to get something down in language, it helped me. And so I began to...
Was it the writing or the reading it back to yourself?
Initially, it was the writing. But as I began to be interested in poetry, it was the reading back to myself. And then, I don't think I was really a poet then. I was a person writing poems. Hmm. I think I began to become a poet later when I went to college, when I began to try and make something, when I tried to turn the words into something. The oldest word for poetry in Greek is poesis, which means making. And a poet is a maker, and a poem is a made thing. And I think that when I was just trying to express myself, I wasn't really writing poems. But when I tried to shape those feelings into something, when I tried to make something, what Carolyn was doing when she was making a sonnet, when you're actually trying to make something, then you're actually on your path towards becoming a poet.
But, you know, Carolyn, so many people say, oh, I don't get poetry. I don't know how to access it. Why do you think it's so hard for some people?
I think that sometimes poetry is taught as a code, and that everything in the poem actually means something else, and that something is a secret, and you have to discover the symbols and what they mean, and people become afraid, and they don't realize that all you have to do is read it and take it in and allow it to affect you, and you don't have to figure it out or translate it into some other terms.
You know, you're talking in the same way I would talk about how people may be afraid of art, that instead of simply allowing the heart to feel, they try to figure it out intellectually.
That's exactly right. And I think it comes from teachers making an attempt to bring poetry into the classroom, but there was a kind of old-fashioned approach that, well, this is a symbol for something else, and do you understand? It's not a rose at all, you know? So people stop seeing the flower, and they get scared, and they think, what is this really?
Do you think they get scared?
When I would look at our, you know, answer this question on an international level, I mean, when we go to other countries, you know, poetry is key to people's lives. You know, when you go to the Middle East, you know, you go to Chile, you go to Nicaragua, you know, when we look at how people grow up remembering, you know, lines of poems. If I'm Cuban, I know Jose Marti. You know, and I think this is the thing when I come back here to the United States. Okay, what poets do we quote? Okay, what poets does everyone quote? You know, who's the American poet? And well, I was talking to Ed earlier, and you know, he's reading his Walt Whitman. You know, and that's what I feel. You know, is we begin there for me. African American language and use is essential, and I think that when you go out here, people have a little bit of the poetry there. You know, and it just has to be a thing where you realize when you see some poems on a page, it might be things that you don't understand, but you have to work at it. I think that's the beauty of it. It's like heavy lifting or deep tissue massage.
You know, I have asked each of our guests today to bring with them a poem of their own that they'd like to share. And Carolyn, why don't I start with you?
Thank you. This poem, I love lighthouses, and I go visit them whenever they're available to me. And there's a lighthouse in Ireland called Hook. And across the water, apparently, there's another lighthouse called Crook. So we have an expression, by hook or by crook.
I think that's
where it comes from. But this is a little history of lighthouses and an homage, and it's also an elegy, a poem written for someone who's no longer with us. The Lightkeeper. A night without ships. Foghorns calling into walled clouds, and you, still alive, drawn to the light as if it were a fire kept by monks. Darkness once crusted with stars, but now death dark as you sail inward. Through wild gorse and sea wrack, through heather and torn wool you ran, pulling me by the hand so I might see this for once in my life. The spin and spin of light, the whirring of it, light in search of the lost, there since the era of fire, era of candles and hollow wick lamps, whale oil and solid wick, colza and lard, kerosene and carbide, the signal fires lighted on this perilous coast in the Tower of Hook. You say to me, stay awake. Be like the lens maker who died with his lungs full of glass. Be the you in blossom when bees swarm. Be their amber cathedral, and even the ghosts of Cistercians will be kind to you. In a certain light, as after rain, in pearled clouds or the water beyond, seen or sensed water, sea or lake, you would stop still and gaze out for a long time. Also when fireflies opened and closed in the pines, and a star appeared, our only heaven. You taught me to live like this, that after death, it would be as it was before we were born. Nothing to be afraid. Nothing but happiness, as unbearable as the dread from which it comes. Go toward the light always. Be without ships.
So beautiful. Beautifully read. Beautifully written.
Thank you.
When did you write that?
Couple of years ago, after the person who is addressed in this poem died of cancer, and I was also under treatment for cancer at the same time, and I feel that he taught me many things, and I wanted to pay tribute to him by writing this poem. He was also a lover of lighthouses. So,
Carolyn Forget is a professor of English at Georgetown University. She's written 4 books of poetry, edited 2 volumes, including the recent The Poetry of Witness. Short break and right back. And welcome back. April is Poetry Month, and so I've invited 3 esteemed poets to join me here in the studio. Carolyn Forget is professor of English at Georgetown University. Edward Hirsch is author of 6 books of poems, 4 books of prose, including the best-selling book How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry, and the recent release of Poet's Glossary. Seems to me that that was highlighted in this morning's Washington Post. And E. Ethelbert Miller, he's director of the African American Resource Center at Howard University, author of several books of poetry and prose, and co-editor of Poet Lore, the longest ongoing poetry magazine, this year celebrating 125 years.
That's older than me.
Congrats, congrats. Right.
Thank you very much.
Ethelbert, this is something you touched on earlier. Here's a tweet from Raymond. He says, does your panel make a distinction between poets and those creating song lyrics?
Well, you know, when you look at, especially the African-American experience, you know, I look at my mentor, Stephen Henderson, who edited the important anthology, Understanding New Black Poetry. And when you go to that anthology, you see that, you know, the blues lyrics, you know, are there. You know, the spirituals are there. When we look at African-American literature, we also have to look at the sermons of ministers. You know, so this is all poetry, especially in terms of the oral tradition, which is very important in many cultures.
And from Abigail on Facebook, who says most people grow up loving poetry in basic nursery rhymes and early books. How do we keep all ages in love with the genre, Edward?
That's a very good point that she's making, that there's a kind of poetry of everyday life. I mean, song lyrics, but also proverbs, riddles, counting out rhymes, jump rope rhymes, the African-American game of playing the dozens. There are all kinds of folkloric terms, but somehow the way that poetry is taught has created a kind of barrier between the poem and people and their own experience of language. And so I think we need to remind people that the terms of poetry, the forms of poetry, are there to enable them to experience something, and they should have the experience itself.
But, you know, poetry, as we think of it as young children, it has evolved so much from that perfect rhyming order to a poem that Caroline has just written. She says she wrote this when she was in third grade as an 8-year-old. She writes, "In the woods where there are tall, towering trees, tiny, timid animals, rigid, rustling leaves, I stand there, just me." Isn't that wonderful?
Sweet.
And you know, other than the alliteration, I mean, there are no rhyming words. And somehow in our heads, we think, a poem has to rhyme. How did we get stuck in that?
This is a 19th century idea, I think partially through Victorian poetry, even though Walt Whitman, one of our greatest American poets, was writing poems that were not in iambic pentameter. They were in long lines that he got from King James, even though Emily Dickinson was fracturing hymns, not using iambic pentameter. She was taking the music that she had heard in church and changing it and radicalizing it. I think there's a sort of conventional language that people think of in poetry and conventional forms of poetry, but actual poetry comes in all kinds of forms. I mean, rhyme is one of the devices of poetry, but it's only one of them.
Read for us a poem of yours, Edward.
It will be my pleasure. This is a poem. It's called Special Orders, and it's an elegy for my father who sold corrugated cartons. He was a box salesman. "Give me back my father, walking the halls of Wertheimer Box and Paper Company with sawdust clinging to his shoes. Give me back his tape measure and his keys, his drafting pencil and his order forms. Give me his daydreams on lined paper. I don't understand this uncontainable grief. Whatever you had that never fit, whatever else you needed, believe me, my father, who wanted your business, would squat down at your side and sketch you a container for it."
Tell me how that poem is different from a paragraph of narrative.
A paragraph of narrative is basically telling you a story or explaining something. My poem is trying to articulate an experience that's hard to articulate, which is, I need a container for my grief. And the poem has a formal idea, which is, I am grief-stricken, and I can't contain my grief, and I want to enact it somehow. But the only person who could contain it was the person who made boxes. That was my father. That feels to me like a form of poetic thinking, and that it tries to enact that feeling, give me back my father when I know I can't get him back, through a form, through an articulation of form, through an experience.
Lovely.
just lovely. Here's an email from Douglas in El Paso, who says, I will never forget listening to my eighth grade teacher reading The Charge of the Light Brigade by Alfred Lord Tennyson. Some of those poems stay in our minds, in our hearts, for so long. What is it, Carolyn, that keeps those poems there, do you think?
Poetry is memorable speech. And there are devices in poetry, some of them they're devices of music that allow the poem to stay with us and stay with us. Sometimes the way a song comes into your head and you can't get rid of
it.
But I do think that poems stay. They enter us in a different way because they enter as musical speech and because of their strange, mysterious quality, which is that something is being said almost as if for the first time.
Musical speech. I love that phrase, Ethelbert.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay.
Have you got
Read? It's called Boxing with Your Mom, epigraph from the poet Yusuf Komunyakaa. Whoever said men hit harder when women are around is right. You push the door open, not knowing what to expect. She sits in a chair next to a hospital bed, just sitting. How long? Before you can even enter the room, a big smile of recognition kisses her lips before she kisses you. Her seamstress eyes survey your clothes. You're a rhinestone of a sun, slipping between her shaking hands. As the sparkle leaves her eyes, she withdraws under her hospital robe. So small she looks, so small she is. You want to leave, but you just came. It's just you and her. You're overmatched. Her moods change so quickly you can't avoid her jabs. There's bitterness in each blow. She has you against the wall. You're fighting with her again. This is sick, you tell yourself. You want to leave, but the bell never rings. You're trying to love her too much. You're losing another round.
Wow. I love that.
Yeah, my mother's deceased now, but when she was ill, I got a call from my sister, and she said, come down and see your mother. We don't know how long she's going to be here. I got down to the hospital, and there my mother was, and in 5 minutes we were arguing, and I knew she was well, you know, and I came out of the hospital with this poem.
Isn't that something? Yeah. You wrote it
right there,
and there. When you wrote the book called How to Read a Poem, what advice did you give to people about not only reading, but allowing it to come in?
You know, when you read a poem, when you read it aloud, you are the instrument of that poem. Your body, your vocal cords, your rhythm, your heartbeat, you become the vehicle of that poem. And the first thing is to just relax, let the poem inhabit you, listen to the sound of the words. When you're reading a poem, you're alone, but you're alone with the words of another. It's a social experience in some way because language doesn't belong to anyone. And I just, you know, I think you just find poems you like and you let them speak to you. Now, the more you're interested in poetry, the more you care about poems, I think you want to know more about it. So say you have a poem, you have experience of poem, the way I first had a poem when I was early in college, and I read a poem and I thought, this poem by Gerard Manley Hopkins is knocking me out. And then the more I looked at it, I go, hey, this thing is a sonnet. How does a sonnet work? I think the more you know about poems, the more you want to know how they work.
Which one by Gerard Manley Hopkins?
It was one of the so-called terrible sonnets, and it begins, I wake and feel the fell of dark, not day. What hours, oh, what black hours we have spent this night. What sights you heart saw, ways you went, and more musty and yet longer light's delay. With witness I speak this, where I say hours, I mean years, mean life. And my lament is cries countless, cries like dead letters sent to dearest him who lives, alas, away.
You recited that from memory.
I did. I memorized it without knowing I was memorizing. I was just reciting the first eight lines of it. But the poem went through me so deeply that Hopkins was articulating some desolation that I felt in myself. And instead of feeling more lonely when I read it, I felt less lonely. I felt less lonely because I felt that he was articulating something that I experienced, but I didn't have a name for.
Is that why you read poetry, Carol?
I think I read for in order to get in touch with the souls of the others, the souls of the other poets. I feel like I'm receiving something from them that I can't get in touch with any other way. And I read for the music, and I read for mystery, too. I read for things I don't understand and don't try to understand. And sometimes poems express things that, emotions or ideas, that they're hovering below the surface of the poem. And that's what I read for. But I also read for lately in the last 20 years, I've been reading for the mark of extremity in poets who endured conditions of extremity in the 20th and 21st centuries, who suffered through wars and exile and prison.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So you termed those kinds of poems the poetry of witness.
Yes. It was a term that I had not for... It's not... You're not an identity, you're not a poet of witness, but it's a term for a way to read poems which have been written in the aftermath of harsh suffering and experience. And we don't really live after things happen. We live in their aftermath. I don't think we get over things or come to closure. I really believe that we learn to live beyond those experiences. And our language also passes through the fires of war and internment and imprisonment and exile. And so that language becomes different. I can illustrate with a poet who people aren't aware of that they know. They know this poet. This poet is John Newton, who was drafted on a Royal Navy ship when he was 23 years old. And he served on that ship, but he tried to escape. When he escaped, he was captured. He was flogged. He was put into irons. He was transferred to another ship where he was forced to become a slave trader. He became a slave trader, and he became a torturer himself. Then his ship was in a storm at sea, and it was breaking up, and he was praying for salvation. And after, and what happened to him finally was that he had a conversion experience. And his conversion experience involved him in the abolition movement finally. Uh-huh. And here is his poem, a few lines from it. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see." We sing it. The civil rights movement adopted it as a song. We sing it at funerals. We sing it when we need to be comforted. We sing it when we need to keep going and keep going to struggle for justice. And so it wasn't always set to music. It began as a poem, and Indeed. We all know the words.
Indeed.
And you know, Carol, you've always been a major influence on my life and the whole thing about witness, but I also connected it to Jimmy Baldwin. And Baldwin always talked about being a witness, and I look at the fact that Baldwin comes out of the African-American church. And once you say that you are a witness, it means that you are called forth to give testimony. You have to testify. You have to speak the truth to the people. And I think that's a tremendous responsibility for anyone out there who's thinking about being a writer. You know, this whole thing of being a witness. We know as we look across the country, there are places where you can't find a witness. People say, I didn't see anything. And why? Because they don't have the courage to deal with what they saw. They don't have the courage to speak the truth. And this is where the poets come in, you see. And Amazing Grace is, I mean, that's key. But look at the transformation of the individual soul. And what happens is that if you are in the front as a witness, you're transforming yourself and hopefully inspiring others to be transformed.
When you take time to read Ethel Byrd, would you tend to go first for a book of poetry or a novel?
Well, you know, now, you know, because I'm editing a magazine, a poetry magazine, I try to be so open now in terms of looking for work that's first different from my own. You know, so that my appreciation of poetry is broadened. I feel that anyone who's editing a magazine, you have a service to the field. You know, the same way Ed is doing these wonderful books in terms of teaching us how to read and appreciate poetry. I think if you're editing a magazine, you want to be engaged with people that you don't see. You want somebody to pick up your magazine or read your magazine online and say, well, I want to send work there, as opposed to saying, well, they'll never publish my work. You know, I want to be inclusive as opposed to, you know, excluding people. But the thing I find is that you learn so much about the human condition that it's wonderful to be an editor as well as a poet.
E. Ethelbert Miller. And we'll take just a short break here. When we come back, we'll open the phones. I look forward to your participation in this conversation about poetry. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University Washington College of Law, with summer law programs for professionals at wcl.american.edu/summer. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to build a culture of health for all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. By the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues, at parkfoundation.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
Seth Meyers.
On the next Fresh Air, Seth Meyers talks about his new job hosting Late Night, replacing Jimmy Fallon, who now hosts The Tonight Show. And we'll look back at some of Meyers' work on Saturday Night Live, where he was head writer and anchored Weekend Update. Join us.
Welcome back, and it's time to open the phones, hear your thoughts on poetry. Let's go first to Beth in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
You are such a beautiful and classy lady, I just have to tell you.
Thank you.
You will lift with your words. I wanted to say that something you guys actually left out, I was surprised. The format of your words speak volumes as to what you're trying to get across. Even when I post something on Facebook, just a comment that doesn't rhyme and, you know, it you know, if you just type it into sentences with periods and that's it, it's kind of boring to me. So I format it. And I am a poet, and I do remember my first poem, by the way, in the third grade, how to eat fishing worms. Wasn't nearly as good as that other gal, so I won't tell you. But anyway, using the dots, using even the symbols that most people don't use, there's a circle under the symbols that's kind of large, when you type it. And when I do my LOLs, I've always done my LOLs differently. I did LOL with a small, well, with the zero instead of the O, because it made it look funky.
Okay, now here's the question for you, Edward. Does the form shape the poem?
Absolutely. I mean, part, you know, poetry is paying attention and slowing down and paying attention to the words. And the form is the delivery system. It's just as we need a body to deliver the soul, the way we live, we need to experience poetry through the language itself. It matters if it rhymes. It matters if it's in stanzas. It matters if it's a villanelle or a song-like form. It matters if it's completely fragmented. That's how we actually, it's the delivery system. It's not just a series of messages. It's how we experience the poem in our bodies. But slowing down, paying attention to it, reading it, noticing it on the page, how it works, that's part of the experience of poetry.
All right, to Randy in Springfield, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Okay. I taught poetry for many years, and one of my favorite quotations, and I cannot remember who said it, is that poetry is the greatest amount of energy in the least amount of space. And that, for me, has always defined what poetry is.
What do you think, Carolyn?
I hadn't heard that, but I agree with it. I don't know who said it either. Do you?
I don't.
No.
All right, but we all agree with it. I like that. Let's go to Susan in Fort Knox, Tennessee, or Fort Knox. Which is it?
It's Fort Knox. It's around Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was actually fortunate to be a friend of Liam Rector's, and I did a lot of photography of poets, and I think I photographed Mr. Hirsch and William Maxwell, I think, many years ago, and took a photograph to Mr. Hirsch.
Huh.
I adored William Maxwell, so it's thank you so much.
I've been working with soldiers with combat trauma and bringing in poetry. And one of the things that I've been finding is that sometimes there will be something that will hit me so deeply. And, of course, the soldiers with their trauma, you know, sometimes I'll be hesitant to bring in something so moving to me that sort of resonates with some of the things that I know about what's going on with these soldiers. But I'll be hesitant because I'll be afraid that it might be too much for them. And one of the poems that I was almost hesitant to bring in is a Stephen Crane poem called In the Desert, which is just a short one. Most of the panel may know it, which is Stephen Crane was a journalist, and he's well known, but he covers a war, and he writes about being in the desert and discovering a creature naked and bestial who's squatting on the ground, and he's holding his heart in his hands, and he's eating of it. And he inquires, he says, "Is it good, friend?" And the man answers it, and he says, "It is bitter." "Bitter," he answered, "but I like it because it is bitter and because it is my heart." And that, I brought it into my soldiers, and it, you know, for some people who haven't talked at all, this, you know, this hits them.
Yeah, I can understand that, Edward.
It's terrific. I mean, because it is bitter and because it is my heart, it's a kind of revelation, because you think of the bitterness as something outside, but then it also expresses a kind of emotion that's from inside. I think it's giving, I mean, you're talking about a war poem that's giving a name to something that people might otherwise not have a name for.
Let me read you an email from Margaret in Garland, Texas, who says, "Because poetry is an intimate expression of humanity, I am of the opinion it should not be subjected to the review of literary critics." What do your guests think about that?
Oh, okay. I agree with that.
You agree with that. How about you, Carolyn?
Unless they happen to like it.
Unless they happen to like it.
I would say there's a point there, and there's a point yes and a point no. I mean, yes, it's possible for people. I mean, because of the intimacy, it's possible to feel that people are trampling on on something you really care about. And it's possible to write about it and feel that you're not recognizing what the person is writing about. On the other hand, as someone who writes a lot of criticism about poetry, I'll say that sometimes people also need some help. And you can sometimes point to things in a poem that people didn't quite realize that were there and that they can experience the poem more fully. So you don't want a critic who runs over the poem, but you can bring out things in the poem that people might not notice themselves but are experiencing and therefore appreciate it more fully.
And here's an email from William. Does the panel think that poetry can still serve as a vehicle for political change in an age when poetic technique has been appropriated by advertising and institutionalized in schools?
Well, you know, we just had in Washington, you know, the Splitters Rock Poetry Festival, which, you know, Sarah Browning organizes here. And you see poets with witness coming together. You see people who are engaged. Many things of us are shaped by many of the issues that are around us. And I like the fact that, once again, poets are part of the inauguration of our presidents, you know, we're center stage. I wish more poets would run for political office. You know, I think that would change the discussions on Capitol Hill. You know, people always want to talk about prayer. I think I will have to have a poem before you talk. It's going to be very instructional. But this is the thing I feel, you know, in our society, we always like to separate the poetry from the politics. You know, this is why I respect, especially you, Carolyn, you know, and I was very close to June Jordan, because writers understand their responsibility in this society. Mm. They understand the power of the word, especially now in terms of the technology. You know, we have to make sure that there are guidelines. I'm glad what Ed said, you know, on a serious note. Yeah, we have to uphold traditions. We have to have guidelines. We have to have rules and regulations. Right now, for example, you can go out here and someone will say, okay, oh, my child's writing a poem. No, your child's really expressing themselves, you know. You know how everybody's like, my child has athletic ability. No, he's just kicking the ball. you know. And you have to have teachers, you have to have guys, and you have to uphold tradition, because at the end of the day, this is who we are in terms of when we look to our poetry, you know, Amazing Grace, you know what I mean? These things are part of our bone structure.
All right, to Fayette, Alabama. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. I'm so glad that you're rested and recuperate, that you had that vacation.
Thank you.
My question comes from the point of view of not, what are they called, professional writers such as newspaper editors who may have had English majors in college, but those of us who had visual arts majors, although I work in many different fields, I love so much drawing in the MGM Warner Brothers Disney style that I'm trying to get into the children's book and comic book fields. And one of the things I'm doing is trying to write about everyday stuff or what's in my head, but to write it in meter, not in sing-song rhymed verse, but in meter. Is that the best way to learn on your own? Because I never took poetry writing classes in college.
Okay, Edward.
I mean, meter is one of the traditional elements of poetry, and I think learning about the meters is, you know, very interesting. I mean, I think if you're thinking about what's the best way to teach yourself poetry, if that's what you're asking for, I think finding poems that you care about and then trying to imitate them, right in the style of imitating the meters, imitating the rhymes, imitating the way the metaphors work. Ultimately, you have to write your own poem. But if you're not going academically, if you're not studying poetry in school, you can put yourself to school on the work of other poets. I mean, the three of us really learned poetry, not from classes exactly. We learned from studying poets. We learned from looking at poets that we loved. We read them. We studied them. We wanted to be like them. And we tried to write like them. I mean, that's how you learn to write poetry.
And that's how you learn to write, period.
That's how you learn anything.
By reading. Exactly. Here's another email from Brian, who says, poetry means so much to me, but my girlfriend prefers nonfiction. She says she doesn't like poetry because it could mean anything depending on the interpretation of the reader. Can your panel recommend a way I could help her fall in love with poetry?
Read to her.
I think that's a lovely idea.
read to her.
If she can't respond to a love poem that you're reading to her because you care about her, I'm a little worried about your relationship.
And maybe even some of the songs of Solomon.
How about those? Those are so sexy.
I mean, they really, really are when you get right down to it. Let's go to Kirsten in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hi, Diane. How are you today?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for your show. I have been a listener for many, many
years. I'm so glad. Thanks.
What I wanted to share with you is that I think many parents underestimate the power of poetry when they're teaching their children to read. My mother taught me to read by reading poetry. She had a book that was her go-to that was called A Thousand Beautiful Things. And the one that sticks out the most was that she would have me read over and over again was Don Blanding's A Vagabond's House, which for a five-year-old is it's an intense poem. And it was powerful because it taught me more about reading and cadence and words and understanding them.
And it clearly stuck with her.
I mean, her point is a very good one. Kids naturally like poetry. They respond to the rhythms. They respond to the music. They like the words. And I think it's a way to introduce them to greater literacy.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Is there another poem you'd like to read for us? Go ahead.
Since you, Ed was giving counseling about love, I will read a love poem.
All right.
And what I tell people, I'm trying to reach this combination of Pablo Neruda and Smokey Robinson. A Time for Love. There are so many minutes after midnight when I think only of your arms, legs, lips, and everything else that moves in the dark. I refuse to believe in morning or daybreak. I am jealous of the sun that pulls you away. If only I could have another second with you now, a moment filled with your breath and beauty beneath the covers. Oh, this love that clings to stars and moonlight, this love that shadows me as if I were the earth beneath your heart.
Now, Ethelbert, that has got to be a poem that this young man who wrote has got to read to his girlfriend, which I think would capture her magically. I want to read to all of you a poem that was written by a dear, dear, dear friend of mine, E.J. Mudd, wife of Roger Mudd, and she died 3 years ago. But she wrote this, and all of us who loved her and who love her still think of what she knew when she wrote this poem and how it speaks to all of us. It's titled Old Wives. What did we think when we promised to love and cherish those barely known men till death did us part and all that? I think what we heard was the first set of terms for richer, for better in health. Who bothered to look through the mist of toll at the contrary side of the vows, for poorer in sickness, for worse? Who ventured a question? How poor? In what sense poor? How sick? Where sick? For how long? For worse? Were there limits to worse? Well, never mind now. After all these years, we've seen it from both sides now. The point is that all of us promised we would, and some of us actually did. I love that poem. It's beautiful.
It's a very touching poem. It's a poem of real experience. You know when you're listening to that poem. First of all, she's parsing the vow in a very interesting way.
Exactly.
But really, it's a poem of, a poem of a grown woman, a poem of adulthood, a poem of someone who's lived through quite a lot of experiences.
And I do miss my friend, EJ. Thank you all so much for being a part of this program. E. Ethelbert Miller, Carolyn Forché, Edward Hirsch, your readings were wonderful. Your insights were glorious. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's wonderful.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rain.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar.